From the Paley Center for Media in New York, this is Max Media. Here's Max Robbins.
Hello, everybody. Welcome again to Max Media, the show that finds out why people in the media do exactly what they do and even how they do it. Today, it truly is a pleasure to be here with my pal, Michael Davis, the author of the best-selling book, Street Gang. Hey, Michael, I'll hold it up so our audience can see it. Come on, this is theater of the mind, radio. Anyway, this is Street Gang, the complete history of Sesame Street. And it is indeed a complete history, a wonderful read about a show that's still going strong decades after its founding and really revolutionized children's television. Michael.
Max.
It's so nice to see you.
Well, listen, you know, it's an honor to be with the Schmooze Master General of the United States.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. That's Mr. Schmooze, the Master General to you. Just a little aside here. Michael and I used to work together. We were together at TV Guide, and he had the, in fact, the challenge of used to edit my column there. And
italicized the word work.
Work, yes. Yes. Believe me, he earned every dime he made. But he's written this wonderful book, and it was many years in the making. Five, actually.
Yeah, 5 years.
And I guess maybe just to start out, you can tell us what compelled you. Why Sesame Street?
Well, I was covering children's television for TV Guide, and I was just enjoying the hell out of it. It's an area of coverage where, you know, not too many people were doing it. So I had wonderful access to my sources. And I did a piece on the 35th anniversary of Sesame Street. And I tend to obsess and over-report. And I just had a ball talking to people. And I went looking for the book on Sesame Street, only to not find it. So I called a friend at the Library of Congress and I said, I must be missing something. Please find this book for me. And it just wasn't there. So I saw an opening.
Wow. And this was really your first time out writing a book. Was there something, I mean, maybe if you could capsulize it, why you saw there was such a compelling story here, why this, I mean, I remember talking to you about it, the early days of this as you were conceptualizing the project, that you said that this the history of Sesame Street had all the kind of the makings of a great work of fiction.
And I believe that. You know, over the years, two people got credit for Sesame Street. Joan Ganz Cooney, the co-founder of Children's Television Workshop and a great lady, a great American, actually, and Jim Henson. Well, the truth is that a lot of credit should go to Joan Ganz Cooney, but a lot less to Jim Henson. And what I discovered was there was this incredible ensemble, a confluence of genius brought together at a time when, you know, it was just the perfect moment in cultural history. And one of those people was named John Stone.
And this is the early 60s we're talking about.
Yeah, late 60s. Late 60s. John Stone became the great executive producer of Sesame Street. He was just a producer at the beginning, but it was his idea to make the setting an urban environment to look like a street in Harlem with a stoop and a newspaper store run by an old Jewish guy and have kids running and playing double dutch on the street. Completely John Stone's idea. And he became the soul of the show. And the more I learned about him and the people who surrounded him, the more I came to understand that there was this great sort of commie tragic story about a group of men, all of whom had names that began with the letter J, all of whom died young, tragically. And so I'd go to these interviews and I'd come home heartbroken talking to people about these great men who left us all too soon. And that gave me the impetus to really keep going. And, you know, it's tough to write a book where four or five of your major characters aren't with us anymore. You know, you have to do so much work to understand who they were, family, friends, associates, you know, to so that you feel like you've got them right. So, you know, it was like writing major obituaries all the time for these guys. And there's an onus that falls upon you. You want to get it right. Just like when you're at a newspaper or a magazine, you write an obituary about someone, you know, God help you if you get it wrong, because you really can't correct it. It should be the greatest, best piece ever written about somebody. So there was a tremendous amount of self-inflicted pressure.
Wow. It sounds like this really, you felt a certain amount of responsibility. How much of that was because, well, 40 years later, I mean, Sesame Street's still going strong, but was the kind of social significance of this program? I mean, this really was the first, before multiculturalism had all this baggage. This truly was a show that they tried to make look like America.
And it took such courage to do it, to have a cast with African-Americans and Latinas and, you know, walking hand in hand. It was really television's first major integrated cast. And Gordon and Susan and the actors who played them were the first sort of nuclear black family on television. And that marriage has, if I can use that word, has existed now for 40 years, long before the Huxtables.
You mean on the Cosby Show? This predates that.
Yes, way predates that. Long before that, there was Gordon and Susan Robinson on Sesame Street.
You know, I guess one fact is interesting, that something like 90% of low-income kids, urban kids, watch Sesame Street.
Yes, and that was the goal from the beginning. I think with the passage of time, people have forgotten that the show was created and targeted to indigents. It was meant to help kids who were arriving at the school door ill-prepared for kindergarten and first grade. And so they knew they would never close the gap between underprivileged children and privileged children, but they wanted to close it a little bit and with this television show.
This is Max Media. We're here today with Michael Davis, the author of a wonderful book, Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. One thing, there, initially some educators, they really felt threatened by Sesame Street. Instead of seeing this as an aid, they saw it as something that was kind of taking the control of the lesson plan away from these preschoolers and kids coming into kindergarten.
They were angry and outraged. Kindergarten teachers had to tear up their curriculum and their lesson plans and start all over again once they realized that kids were arriving at school knowing the alphabet and knowing how to count upwards to 20 and downwards back to 1 and knowing their shapes and letters. So, yeah, the teachers were very unhappy that they had to do more work.
C is for kooky, that's good enough for me. C is for kooky, that's good enough for me. C is for kooky, that's good enough for me. Oh, kooky, 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 start with C.
But the other thing, too, was interesting about this. Wasn't there a philosophy from the very beginning, from the roots of Sesame Street, that learning can be fun and this was a show for kids and that it had to have at least a little bit of amount of mischief and irreverence in it?
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm old enough to remember a time in school where learning was not fun. It was rote, and the primers that we used when I was in first grade and second grade were, you know, not imaginative, and it was not any fun. And here comes along this television show that suggests something revolutionary, that if you really make teaching enjoyable, that the kids will follow along and do as well or better than they might do in school, which was, of course, very threatening. And, you know, I remind people in the book that the show was created to mimic Laugh-In, Rowan Martin's Laugh-In on NBC, which was, of course, a landmark comedy show.
Real cut, real short little bits,
absolutely.
Boom, a lot of catchphrases.
Absolutely, knock-knock jokes, blackouts, little stand-up bits. And humor became the lubricant that greased the wheels of Sesame Street. They wanted it to be funny from the very start. So when they created a writing staff, they didn't go out and get people who knew preschool education and, you know, child development theory. They hired comedy writers and taught them child development.
I'm sure at the time that was completely counterintuitive.
It totally was. And think about being a comedy writer and trying to write stuff that would make 3- and 4-year-olds laugh, how hard that is to do. And when you interview them, what they tell you is that, well, we didn't try to write to 3- and 4-year-olds. We just tried to write funny stuff. And when you look at the early Bert and Ernie bits on Sesame Street, and you close your eyes, it sounds just like radio comedy, classic radio comedy. You don't have to see the screen to get it.
You can close your eyes and laugh.
You can.
Interesting. The because I think we think of the show as being so visual and these vivid Muppet characters that Jim Henson created.
But the writing was brilliant, Max.
That was it. All started with the writing.
Always.
Speaking of writing, this was your first time out writing a book. I mean, you're a veteran journalist. You've worked at major metropolitan daily newspapers in Chicago and Baltimore. You were a TV guide for, what, 7 years?
9 years.
9 years. And felt like seven.
Yeah. no, it felt like 12.
Well, that's for another show. Yeah. But how did you go about really crafting the proposal for this? I know you'd done some of the work, as you were saying, preparing the Sesame Street special for TV Guide.
Yes.
But how did you manage to really craft this proposal? You're a first time book author, publishing business notoriously tough to crack into.
Yes. Well, I tried to squeeze in interviews whenever and however I could, at lunchtime, on the weekends, at nights when I got home late. My wife and I would get in the car on weekends and we would drive to New Jersey or Connecticut or wherever to interview writers and producers and actors and puppeteers. And I spent a year doing that, sat down, and I couldn't write the proposal.
You mean you spent a year just researching it?
Yes.
Before you even,
yes,
clicked out the first sentence of a proposal?
Exactly. On my own dime, because I so believed in the project. And then when I did sit down to write the proposal, I realized that, believe it or not, that it was underreported. I didn't feel like I had my arms wrapped around the entire story, the arc of the story. So I put in another year on my own dime. And so in 2006, I was ready to write that proposal.
And then what happened? You've got this proposal.
Yes. And I have a wonderfully funny Meshuggah agent named Mark Reiter, who helped me craft it. And he's a wonderful editor and writer, as well as a brilliant agent. And so it was ready to, by the time it went out to publishers to give them a chance to take a look, it really was polished, and I was very proud of it. And we did have a little bit of a feeding frenzy on the day that, you know, a bit of an auction.
And here you are, first-time writer.
Yes.
So at this point, this is kind of a certain amount of validation of 2 years' work, that you say, this is a story that needs to be told and people are going to want to hear. It's one thing for you to feel that way. But
yeah. But I think really what it was giving them an opportunity to see that there was a great untold story about Sesame Street, and Sesame Street has so many millions of people who loved it, watched it either with their children or when they were children. So they understood that there was a market out there for the book. And that was a really important part of it, because, you know, when you're an author these days, writing a proposal, marketing and publicity has to be a really big part of it.
It's huge. We all walk into the local Barnes and Noble or Borders or you know, independent bookseller, and we go on Amazon.com. And man, it's just, you're in it. How does something cut through? I mean, you got a very lucrative deal for this book. I mean, it was in this, especially for a first-time writer. I mean, it was in six figures.
I was,
I believe what's been reported.
You can. And I'm very, very happy to say so, because it did validate 2 years of work. You know, one thing that I now understand, 5 years out, is that my Rolodex had a big part in Viking buying my proposal. That I knew you, that I had, you know, outreach to producers across the country and editors across the country.
Wait a second. So Viking's not just looking at you, Michael Davis, who spent 2 years of research, has written a very compelling proposal for a book. They're looking at you as Michael Davis. This guy can be our marketing partner.
Yes, sir. That I did TV spots, live TV spots, when I was a TV guide, when I did radio, that all factored into my proposal. Because not only did they feel confident that I could write the book, they felt confident that I could be out there and sell the book. I now realize that.
That part and parcel, you getting that deal.
Yes. If I had been a shy flower who, you know, wouldn't have picked up the phone and called editors and producers around the country, I would have made less money.
Wow. This is Max Media you're listening to. We're here with Michael Davis, the author of Street Gang, the complete history of Sesame Street. And indeed it is. The book took you 5 years to complete, Michael. How did you stay focused? How did you stay in it, in the moment of this? That's a lot of time. That's a lot of time about to spend on a kid's show.
It is. But I will tell you, the key to it all is enjoying it, is living in the moment and looking forward to your interviews and just finding the joy in the process. And I did. I never had a bad day writing this book. I had days when I was, you know, less productive, but I just fell in love with the topic and woke up every morning compelled to get downstairs and get started. I wanted to.
But then the book comes out. I mean, you've spent all this time.
Yes.
And it's like, well, is this going to all be for naught? Will this just be on the remainder shelf in a couple weeks? Mm-hmm. Fortunately, that wasn't the case.
Yes.
That the book made the New York Times bestseller list, the expanded list. I think it rose as high as number 32.
It did.
Have you been happy so far out there selling it? I know you've been doing a lot of television, a lot of radio.
Okay. The hardest part of writing a book, as far as I'm concerned, is that period from the time that you hand in your manuscript to the time that it's published, that dark period, you know? And it was during that period that I was kicking myself in the behind for not having a video camera or high-definition video camera with me at a lot of the interviews and having better quality audio, because I really wanted to do what's called a book trailer to put up online. And I didn't have the goods. I didn't have the video. And, of course, it was prohibitively expensive to go to Sesame Workshop and ask them for some video, right?
Sure.
That wasn't going to happen. But if it was just me interviewing a source with my bringing in a video camera and getting my own material, I could have used it and I could have put it up on my own website. By the way, creating the website was very, very, very important.
Do you have some sense of how many books you've sold through your website?
At least 2,000, between 2,000 and 5,000 books on my own.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. In fact, people can go to that website. Here, we'll give you a little plug.
Thank
here.
Thank you. Streetgangbook.com. And for you authors out there,
streetgangbook.com.
Yes.
Okay.
And for you authors out there or would-be authors out there, I implore you to give a lot of thought to your website and launch it well in advance of your book's publication, because you on your own with the expenditure of just maybe a few thousand dollars can begin planting seeds out there in the world. And it's just amazing how quickly, how geometrically it becomes known. And I'll tell you a funny story about this. Some knucklehead at some point in the process decided that my name was Michael Justin Davis. And I don't know who the hell Michael Justin Davis is, but it began showing up everywhere.
Justin.
Yeah.
Michael Davis.
You're right. Bum, dum, dum, dum. So, you know, it's like, how do you get rid of that mistake on the internet once that happens is a real challenge. So, you know, things can go wrong as well as things can go right.
Did you, in your experience out there selling this book and you know, your passion for it's palpable. Were there places that were particularly effective? I know you tried to get on Oprah. Everybody does. That's the holy grail for authors. The morning shows, the network morning shows are big. Now, did you do?
I wasn't able to get a morning show. And I can't tell you why, because I would have thought that it would have been a slam dunk. But the producers at the morning show wanted Muppets to come on with me. And I'm a journalist, and I don't work for the Jim Henson Company, and I don't work for Sesame Workshop. So it's not like I could call Elmo and have him come to the studio. So that may have played a part. But I will tell you, Max, Diane Rehm can sell books.
You mean on NPR?
NPR. She's a lovely lady.
What's the show called?
The Diane Rehm Show. She has such a literate audience, and the people really pay attention.
So you would do a show like that, and you immediately see a spike in your Amazon numbers.
A amazing spike. Two radio shows did it for me. The Diane Rehm Show and Judy Markey on WGN Radio in Chicago. She has a show with another woman and a daily show. And I bet that radio appearance was responsible for at least 1,000 books in one day being sold. And so radio has been my friend. I'll tell you that. TV's great. I've done a lot of local TV and not too much national stuff, but radio has been a very effective tool for me.
Did you find that when you – there was a story I remember seeing on CNN.com.
Yes.
On their website, not on CNN, the network.
No. Another huge spike. A huge spike in visitors to my website and activity on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. Wow. So, yes, I was really amazed and astounded to see the response to that CNN.com story. Yes.
That really sent sales soaring.
Yes.
You know, Michael, getting back to the book in Sesame Street, I mean, how relevant is Sesame Street today? Is it still have the same resonance? I mean, there's so much more literate, if you will, programming for children.
I still think it's the gold standard for preschool shows. I still think they are adventurous and contemporary. And this past season, they had such great 3D CGI animation. And, you know, they use the best of New York's filmmakers to do the short films. It renews itself every year with new research. So I give them a lot of credit for keeping up with the times. But the truth is that they have tremendous competition through Nickelodeon, Disney Channel, Discovery Kids, and competition like they've never had before for those little eyeballs.
Can that get into the DNA of a show and get them away from what makes them special?
Well,
and they can try. Yes. I think you write about how they were threatened by, felt really threatened by Barney. And,
yes.
Do you think that that's at points kind of threatened to short circuit them?
It could. It did for a short time, but they found their way. And now I think they're back at a place where they're so confident about what they do. And maybe because the show has circumnavigated the world and there are, you know, it's seen in 140 different countries and it does so much good in so many places that they believe in their model.
There was some criticism over the years,
yes,
and especially in kind of the post-Barney era.
Yes.
That the commercialism has kind of outweighed some of the artistry of it. And we saw, you know, all that incredible, the licensing and all the money they made off of Elmo and all those things.
Yeah.
Do you think there's some validity in that?
Yeah, I think people have every right to question it. But what they would say back to you, and I think this is true, that their mission now is almost evangelistic. It's to spread Sesame Street across the world, and it's a very expensive proposition.
How many countries is it in
140.
Now? Wow.
And they really like to get into the hot spots. They're in Northern Ireland. They were in the former Yugoslavia. They really like to
South
get
Africa South was
Africa,
a big thing.
Yeah, with the HIV-positive Muppet character. So it's those projects that, you know, are expensive, and that's where they get their revenue through licensing and merchandising and sponsorships. The domestic show is very expensive. It's shot in the most expensive city in the United States at Kaufman Astoria Studios. They've got huge production costs.
In the borough of Queens in New York, yes.
Absolutely. And they only do 26 shows a year. In the beginning, they did 130. They don't have any extraneous funding anymore. They certainly don't get it from the government. They get a little bit. And philanthropic sources. So they have to raise the money. And they have a pretty big bureaucracy at Sesame Workshop. They just cut 20% of their staff, 67 people, in recent days. And that's huge. That's huge.
Was that when you heard that? Was that almost like kind of, did you almost take that personally, being so engaged with the show and the people there?
Yeah, I know a lot of people who lost their jobs. In fact, I heard from one last night who has been working here for 15 years. She's a Canadian by birth, and she's going to have to go back to Canada within 30 days because she doesn't have employment anymore. There are a lot of sad stories out there, but listen, it's tough all over.
Yeah, it certainly is. couple things because we're going to have to wrap up pretty soon here. The you took a little heat on the book from in a couple quarters, a couple of the reviews where they thought that you didn't spend enough time on the kind of post Jim Henson era, the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
That you paid a lot of attention to the history and the formation of it.
Yes.
2020 hindsight, would you do it differently?
No. I will tell you this. I was dead set on writing no more than 400 pages, Max, because the book feels, when you go into the bookstore, you feel like you can get this read. I did not want to write some Halberstamian tome that if it fell off the coffee table would kill a small pet. I wanted to write a book that people would read. And yes, I took some criticism. And, you know, who knows? Maybe I'll come back and write a sequel.
Well, that brings me to the next question here.
Yes.
Because we always like to look towards the future.
Yes.
You got another book?
I actually have two. One is a bit of a surprise. It's even a bit of a surprise to me. I don't know where it came from. I'm working on a novel for young readers, based on my experience as a junior high school in 1966 and 67, and I'm working on a book about an incredible basketball game that was played in the 1970s and what became of the men who were involved in it.
Very interesting. Could you see spending another 5 years on one book?
Yes, the second book.
Does your wife know that?
she is even paler than usual when I bring that up. I only know one way to work, Max, and that's like you, hard and long and to try to get it right. And if it takes 5 years to get it right, I'll take 5 years.
Well, I hope you come visit us again before then. This is Max Media. We've been enjoying a wonderful conversation with Michael Davis, a dear friend, the author of Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And I want to invite your listeners to write to me. Just come to the website.
What's that website again?
It's streetgangbook.com.
Terrific. Thanks again. You've been listening to Max Media, and come visit us again soon.
You've been listening to Max Media, a production of the Paley Center for Media in New York City. We're on the web at paleycenter.org. That's P-A-L-E-Y center.org. And you can reach us by email at maxmedia@paleycenter.org.